Hello, I'm Carolyn Vallee.
And I'm Kate Vallee.
And this is Friday Night at Blockbuster, the podcast about our favorite movies from the 2000s. We're both a little under the weather this week, so bear with us.
Apologies.
We might not sound the best, but we're here to talk about a good movie, so we're going to power through. Before we get to the movie, though, Kate, some big awards have been handed out over the last few days. We're obviously awards watchers.
Yes.
Sometimes to an obsessive degree.
I think more so in the past couple of years with our fantasy pool.
Yeah, well, we've already talked about this before, but we did kind of shake things up about 4 or 5 years ago. Instead of just picking winners at the Oscars, we're now doing like a whole award season sort of competition. It does mean, unfortunately, like before the Oscars even roll around this year, I am out of the running.
Oh, really? You're done?
I am so far away from winning this thing that, you know, I might as well just put my feet up and start looking forward to next year's movies. You're still in with a little bit of a shot.
I'm in a little bit. Yeah. Hey, you're not at the bottom of the barrel, though.
I'm not at the bottom of the barrel, but I don't think I'll ever be last. But yeah, this year I have Ferrari and Maestro as my top two picks, and those have not panned out very well for me so far. But the Golden Globes happened, the Critics' Choice Awards happened. These two awards are kind of vying for like second tier. You know, like the Oscars are definitely the big thing. These two are sort of fighting it out between themselves to be, well, what's the second most important award? And so they both happened over the last few days.
And I think usually they're pretty good like precursors. Like usually whatever does fairly well there has like a good chance at the Oscars. So
they definitely can be like I know we've talked about this before, and I'm sure I've talked to other people, but like the Oscars kind of sometimes feel like a culmination of what has already happened over the last couple months in terms of like if somebody gets up on stage at one of these award shows and delivers a fun, passionate, insightful speech, then the other award shows take note and they say, well, like, I want them to do that for us too.
Exactly.
And so all of a sudden that train starts rolling and, you know, we can sit at home and sort of say, well, this person was better than that person. But ultimately, like, I don't want to say it is a popularity contest, but it does, these things do feed into each other.
Yeah. So what's kind of been winning lately?
Well, so it's a good year if you have Oppenheimer in the Oscar pool. It did sort of feel like in July when it came out, it was really, okay, that's the big heavy hitter this year. That is obviously the front runner. It's obviously the one who's, you know, probably going to dominate below the line. Let's see if it can get over the line with actors and Chris Nolan and all that sort of stuff. And it's doing it.
Yeah.
It's doing it. It kind of steamrolled the competition at the Golden Globes. It won the most Critics' Choice Awards. I think this is maybe a foregone conclusion that Oppenheimer is going to be the winner this year.
Which doesn't surprise me, but it does, because in past years, if it's kind of talked about too early, it usually loses the steam by kind of this award season, I find. And like something else is kind of snaked in and picks up all of the winners by the end. So
I just had this conversation the other day with somebody like, you're right in terms of like the movie that is kind of the front runner in September, October tends to then face a backlash by the end of the year that knocks it off the pole position.
Yeah.
And I think a couple things about Oppenheimer that maybe make it a little bit different this year. Like, you know, there's still time for the backlash to
come. That's true.
There is still definitely time. I don't really hear sort of any real criticism of the movie. The only thing I hear is that it's too long for people, but it's like, come on, get over it. Like,
yeah,
it's not even the longest movie of the year. Like, let's get past length. I think the thing that maybe sets Oppenheimer apart is one, it made $1 billion. So it has the like popular support behind it. Like, whereas in years past, these movies that are tend to be the front runners at the, you know, September, October time, is because they've done well at the festivals. And we love the festivals. We go to TIFF as much as we possibly can. A lot of people don't have that chance. And so what ends up happening then is there's a lot of hype around these movies, but regular movie viewing people haven't had a chance to see it yet. And so by the time they get to see it, they're sort of like, well, that didn't really you know, the hype didn't match
yeah.
my experience there. Whereas because Oppenheimer came up before the festivals, $1 billion worth of people have already seen it.
That's true.
And now we've sat through the festival movies and we're sort of like, no, I think Oppenheimer's still better. So I think that's one of the big things that's keeping it as the number one movie so thus far anyways. And I think people also just recognize that it, you know, it might be time to award Christopher Nolan some awards. Like,
has he never really won anything?
I think he's won screenplay once.
Oh, okay. Maybe.
Because he tends to make like genre movies, like, you know, he spent a decade making Batman movies.
That's true.
You know, they were never really going to break through in terms of Oscars and awards and, yeah. and whatnot in terms of that. Now, obviously, the whole thing around The Dark Knight is the reason why the Oscars have changed so much in the last 10 or 15 years is because there was such an outrage and such a support for the Batman movie that the Oscars were just like, no, it's a Batman movie. And then people were like, you fucked up there. Like, you missed the boat on that one. You know, and I've sat on this podcast and said, you know, he's maybe not a top 10 director in Hollywood and all that sort of stuff. But I do think it would be hard to look at his body of work, especially over the last few years with this and with Dunkirk, and sort of be like, I think, you know,
it's time.
It might be time. And then the interesting thing with him is if he does win it for this, does he maybe start making another type of movie? Because now he doesn't need to chase Oscar anymore.
He goes back to his maybe little genre movies.
Like, who knows? Who knows? Like, I would love to see him get back to something like Memento or Insomnia, where it's like they're a little bit smaller budget. They're just like little crime movies with a bit of a twist on them. Oppenheimer didn't cost, I think, all that much money when you compare it to other sort of epic blockbusters. But yeah, I think he clearly wants it. He clearly wants to have an Oscar under his belt and, like, you know, good on him and whatnot. But I would be curious to see what he starts making afterwards. Or, like, does he go even further into this sort of passion projects that he's been doing over the last few years and sort of say, well, now I've got it. Like, now I can really push the envelope.
Yeah. Has there been any movie so far that's, like, not winning the awards that you're a bit shocked about?
Well, I would have hoped Maestro.
Well, your two, obviously. But other ones?
I don't know. I'm a little bit surprised that The Holdovers is doing as well as it is.
Okay.
I watched The Holdovers. I enjoyed it. I thought it was, like, all right. There was, like, a little bit missing from it for me. I'm a big fan of Alexander Payne's Election movie, and I just found Election to be, like, a bit more acidic than The Holdovers is. Like, The Holdovers is, like, very nice and very warm, and I can understand why people like that, but I like the Alexander Payne movies where he's maybe twisting the knife a little bit more. So that, like, that's doing really well. Barbie, I think Barbie's just run into sort of a wave of other movies that are just beating it.
I think Barbie might just be like a fan favorite. Like, I think people will always just love Barbie, but maybe it just won't get the awards, which is fine.
Yeah.
Like, it can still be the fan favorite.
It made the most money this year. Yeah. So, like, that in and of itself is a huge reward.
Yeah, because I think it won an award.
A
show. So, but I'm trying to think of what show it was now. I can't remember.
It was the Golden Globes, and it was for cinematic achievement in box office.
Okay.
Which, like, is the dumbest award. Because here's... So, okay. Let's unpack this a little bit. So, a couple of years ago, the Oscars tried to do that popular Oscar award. And then, like, the backlash came out and they immediately scrapped it.
Oh, yes. I do remember. Because they didn't pick popular movies or something. Yeah. Like, they missed movies.
It was their attempt to sort of be like, okay, we understand that the movies that we're nominating and the movies that we are saying are the best movies of the year are maybe not the movies that the most people are seeing or getting a chance to see or very interested in seeing, whatever the reason are. So as an attempt to bring viewers to watch the show, they said, well, we're going to have a popular Oscar. We're going to award an Oscar for a movie that people actually went out and saw. the backlash then came out and was like, this is the stupidest idea ever. Their reward is that they made money.
Yeah.
Like, that is their reward. So the Oscars scrapped it. The Golden Globes then said, that sounds like a good idea. Let's do that. And so they had this cinematic achievement and box office award that they gave to Barbie. The problem with having it this year, they obviously didn't know that this was going to happen, but the two most popular movies of the year were Barbie and Oppenheimer, which are already competing in all of the other yes. categories because they're good movies. Like, the whole point of cinematic achievement and box office was to give the award to something like Mission Impossible or Fast and the Furious.
Where it wouldn't have been competing for other...
They're not going to be competing for other awards because they're not at the level, Mission Impossible aside. But Fast and Furious is not at the level of Barbie.
Yes.
Even though they make generally the same amount of money. So yeah, when you have a movie like Barbie or Oppenheimer where they are, I think, the number one and number two or number one and number three sort of the yearly box office, sort of like... Well, they've got the other awards over there. Yeah. Like, why? What is this award doing? And then they gave the award to Barbie, which is the number one movie of the year. So then it's sort of like, well, is the number one movie of next year just going to win? Because at that point, why nominate five other movies?
Yeah.
Just give it to the movie that made the most money. So it's a pretty stupid award. I really genuinely don't understand.
So you want it scrapped for next year. Just get rid of it.
I just don't get it. Like, I can understand them wanting... to bring more eyeballs to the TV by being like, you know, maybe your favorite movie, maybe the movie you went to go see is going to win something. What I would say to those executives who are making these TV shows like the Oscars and Golden Globes and stuff is like, do we really think that people who are not going to watch the Golden Globes are going to actually tune in because Mission Impossible might win an award?
Yeah.
Like, I think those people are gone. So stop catering to those people. We need to move on and we need to make the show good for the people who are going to watch because they liked Poor Things.
Yes. Yeah, I think you need like smaller niche categories.
Stop chasing 30 million viewers. Those days are gone.
Yeah.
They are over. So just make a good show for the 10 million people who are tuning in. But, you know, I'm not in charge of these decisions, so...
We were discussing before we came on kind of some of the award shows that we were looking at. And I came across one that I don't know if I noticed last year, the AARP Grown Up Awards.
Yeah, the movies for grown-ups.
And I think they need more categories like these guys.
These are great. These guys have been on our award season fantasy league since the beginning.
I just must have missed them before.
They are like, pretty fantastic.
Like, Best Intergenerational Film?
Yep.
Sounds like a great category. This one, Best Time Capsule?
Yep.
I think I looked at last year's list and there was about something about most adult love story or something. Like, those are great categories.
The AARP basically caters to like movie fans like 50 plus, 60 plus. And so you do get these like strange little categories and these strange little movies that are nominated where you're just like, that is awesome. That is a great nomination because like they're not nominating Barbie. No. Because it doesn't fall into their purview. And so it does free them up to be a little bit stranger.
Yeah.
Get weird with it.
And I've seen it in a few other ones. I like the category of best ensemble.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's nice to award the great, like the bigger group that was a part of the film and not just one specific person.
Like, so. Yeah, I get, like, it can be hard because you look at something like Oppenheimer, I think, won it for the Critics' Choice Awards. And... you're sort of like, yeah, Cillian Murphy's great. He's clearly the lead of the movie. There's like 7 or 8 really great supporting roles in that movie and really great supporting performances. And you're sort of like, how do you possibly pluck out
one person
to be like, that's the person we're nominating? And like, obviously, Robert Downey Jr. is getting a lot of credit and a lot of plaudits because he's kind of playing the antagonist to Oppenheimer. But like, Matt Damon is just as good.
Yeah.
Just as good. In another supporting role. You know what I mean? Emily Blunt is good. Florence Pugh is just as good. So, you know, the Ensemble Award is a nice sort of like catch-all.
Yeah.
To sort of be like, you know, this whole production...
was good.
Was good. You guys all did a great job. Should we jump to the movie?
Jump to the movie? So, we talked about it last week a little bit.
Yeah.
It's the movie that you fell in love with and helped fall in love with movies, I guess.
Well, yeah, it shaped a lot of why I'm sitting here today. But anyway, we're going back to July 6, 2001, which is the Friday we could have rented Snatch, Guy Ritchie's Snatch. So first question is, you said last week that I had made you watch this when you were younger.
Yes.
You were probably too young to watch this movie.
Extremely too young.
Yeah. Have you watched it in any of the preceding years, or is this the first time that you've seen it probably since that time?
This was the first time, so I probably haven't seen it since early 2000s.
Right.
Because I would have watched it, and I think we might have mentioned last week kind of the sister movie, The Lock, Stock,
yeah,
and Two Smoking Barrels. You made me watch both of those. And so...
The movie challenges were starting young.
Yeah. And I just remember going into school being like, I found my new favorite movie, and everybody being like, what is it? And I was, Snatch. And they're like, never heard
of
it.
What the hell is that?
Kate, I think you're making it up. Like, so yeah, no, I haven't seen it since early 2000s. What's fun for me, though, is a movie like this, I remembered a lot of it. I didn't quite remember all of the lines and things like that, but I remembered big picture and kind of a little bit of the story and kind of where it was going to go. And so for me, that just helps like solidify that like it was a good movie, that it made that impact.
Right. That it's probably been about 20 years.
And I still remember a lot of it. So, but my first question for you, how did you find this movie?
Yeah. So I was thinking about it, obviously. And like I've said this before about Snatch and Guy Ritchie, where it was like at one point in my life, he was probably the most important filmmaker in my life, because he kind of did open a lot of doors in terms of like these types of movies and whatnot. And so I was thinking about it all week, because I was like, she's definitely gonna ask this question, so I need to have an answer. And I think I came to the realization that like growing up, we've talked about it on the podcast, but like there wasn't that many movies in the house. I think our parents liked movies and, you know, would take us to the video store to rent things here and there.
We would go to Blockbuster and the other local one.
The other local one. But it was a sort of, in terms of in the house, there were like John Wayne Westerns. There were a few sort of like historical epics like Braveheart or Robin Hood. And then you would obviously have brought in some Disney movies and things like that. Like, I don't think I was actually that big into Disney movies as a kid. Seeing Braveheart at 5 years old, probably
nixed that one in the bud a little bit. Yeah, you were a John Wayne kind of kid, I think.
The John Wayne Westerns, even more than the Westerns, but like the John Wayne Westerns were definitely the movies I grew up watching. And so I just don't even think I had this concept of like a smaller, sort of more independent movie, you know, set in modern times about criminals like this. And so I think about the ages of like 11, 12, 13 is when I sort of discovered and got really invested and really interested in the whole IMDb,
you know,
top 250, the IMDb chat forums and things like that, where people were just like talking about movies. And because IMDb has a bit of a like a recency bias, like a new movie when it comes out sort of shoots right to the top of the rankings, and then slowly as more people see it, it comes down and down and down. Because Snatch would have been relatively new, it probably was really high on that list. And so I was looking at this movie and sort of being like, well, you know, it's new. And not that I necessarily knew who these people were, but I think I had enough about me at the time to sort of be like, it's got Brad Pitt. I kind of know who Brad Pitt
is. Yeah, you probably would have recognized a couple of the names. I
would have recognized a couple of the names. And then, so like it was kind of on my radar and it was kind of building up. And then it was our neighbor who was the same age as me. I think I said something about this movie and he said, we've got it.
Oh, really?
And his stepfather was a huge, huge movie buff and would like seek out movies like this, where it's sort of like a little bit more of a hidden gem, you know, didn't really come out in the movie theaters in Canada, but like he would like go find it. And so then it was like, can I borrow it? can I watch it? Like, it was an immediate thing. And so I just remember the first time watching the movie, this is a whole new world. This is a whole new genre to the movies that I had been watching. And then you find out that he had already made another movie like this You're like, well, I immediately want to watch that one now too. And so once you watch both of them back to back, like the doors were wide open. And so, yeah, like I have very vivid memories of watching these for the first time and then being like, I want to watch hundreds of movies like this. And I've done that. I have done that.
Well, what's fun for me is obviously having watched those two and then a few years later when he came out with like the Sherlock movies.
Yeah.
I remember being like, oh, Guy Ritchie. I was like, oh, I know that name and I recognized it. And I really enjoyed the Sherlock Holmes because they kind of had the same idea where it was the fast talking, the quick edits and things like that. And so like, I love those two movies. So I haven't seen a lot of his other stuff, but.
Well, we can get into maybe Guy Ritchie and my feelings to him now. Like I will praise him a lot for movies like Snatch, but you know, it's been dicey lately. Just watching it again, because I haven't seen this movie in a long time. Even though at one point it probably was my favorite movie. Kind of moved on. My tastes have evolved. So I probably haven't watched Snatch in 10 or 15 years. And watching it again the other night, I was sort of like, oh, he is very much the UK version of Quentin Tarantino, at least at this time.
Okay.
And there was just a lot of overlap that I was able to sort of be like, oh, that is that. That is that. And not to necessarily say that like Ritchie didn't have his own style and things like that. But I think it's very apparent that he is influenced by Quentin Tarantino and like what Quentin Tarantino had done in the 90s.
Oh, yes, because Tarantino came out with some before.
Yeah, like Tarantino at this point, I think, had done 3 or 4 movies by the time that Guy Ritchie did his first. And so I think by that stage, Guy Ritchie had sort of been like, oh, this is definitely a blueprint. And so you have things like the whole opening scene when they're talking about the Virgin Mary is like very reminiscent of the whole conversation around the diner table in Reservoir Dogs about Like a Virgin and things like that. Like, it's just unlikely people talking about something that you would on the Facebook be like, I can't believe they're talking about that.
Yeah.
Like, that's just a regular conversation. And in Reservoir Dogs, it's a bunch of gangsters. And in this, it's a bunch of Jewish rabbis who turn out to be gangsters.
Yeah.
But yeah, like there's things like that. There's things, obviously, like we've already talked about the sort of the whole fast dialogue. And it's got this rhythm to it that just kind of carries you through scenes. Even when not a whole lot is necessarily happening, there's like a musicality to it. And then, of course, like the whole thing about just criminals being regular people.
Yeah.
Like throughout Snatch, there is a whole host of characters where you're just like, they're on the fringes of respectable life. And they have fingers in sort of the criminal underground, but they're not necessarily masterminds.
Yeah, they're not the big criminals.
They're not the big criminals. They maybe have an idea of what's going on and maybe have an idea of how to make a little bit of extra money, but like they're not calling the shots. They're not pulling the strings. And like that was definitely something that was very apparent in Tarantino's like early work, where it's sort of like it's just a bunch of guys who don't have a problem with violence. And so they get hired to rob a bank.
Yeah.
And you're sort of like, yeah, but they're not in charge of anything. They're kind of bums. So, yeah, watching it again the other night, I was like, oh, there's a lot of overlap here. There's a lot of similarities. So we talked about the editing.
Yep.
That was another thing that was like very apparent. So how do you feel and how do you handle sort of movies that are a little bit more like this where like it is chaotic at times?
I was kind of thinking about it and I made a note. In a previous podcast, we talked about great openings and stuff. And, like, I kind of forgot about this opening when they're introducing you to all the characters. And, like, the really quick scenes there. And the fact that something's passed out of a frame and then into another frame. And it's something a little different or whatever. So, like, that kind of editing I loved. It was so good to watch again. I don't mind the quick scenes. I find sometimes for me it actually keeps my focus a little bit more, because if a scene goes on for too long, I find sometimes I'm sitting there being like, okay, well, like, just move along, like, let's get to the next point. Where when they're so quick, it's kind of like, oh, okay, we're done with this, oh, okay, now we're on this side, like, or oh, good, we're back to this story. Because I do find sometimes with movies like this where there's, I don't know, 6 different storylines almost.
Yeah.
Like,
there's like six storylines sort of with about 20 characters kind of coming in and out of
each other's and various points or whatever. Inevitably, you do find that there would be one storyline which isn't your favorite story.
Yeah.
And so when you're watching those scenes, because they're so quick, you're kind of like, well, I know this is going to be over soon. And then I get to go back to this guy and I actually like his story, or I want to see where that one goes. So the quick editing, I really like.
I found watching it again the other night, I was like, oh, he's not letting any of this get boring.
No.
Like, as soon as any one scene is maybe tipping over to sort of like, we've been here too long, he's moving on to something else. And then the few scenes where he understands, like, okay, it's two people in a car talking, I kind of have to stay here for a couple minutes.
Yeah.
He's going to cut that between like two other scenes with people in cars talking. And he's just going to go back and forth between the three of them. So that it's not, you know, 2 minutes here, then 2 minutes here, then 2 minutes there. It's sort of 15 seconds, 15 seconds.
Yeah.
And you're just like, whoa. And like, it is like, we've talked about it before in terms of sometimes there's movies where the story is maybe complicated or whatever. And it's sort of a, like, get on board or get lost behind. In this, I found it with the editing where it was sort of like, you either like sink in and just let the movie do its thing, or you're sort of just like, this is too chaotic, and you just get overwhelmed.
Yeah, no, I definitely sunk in. So
I like, it works for me. Like, you know, this isn't Shakespeare. This isn't, you know what I mean? Like, he's not going to let these things just play out. He's going to give you the information. He's going to show you what he needs to show you. And he's moving on to something else. And it does give the whole movie this like relentless pace of, you know, you don't necessarily know where we're going and you don't know where we're going to converge. But it is like that steam train of just like, it's just chugging along and you're not stopping it.
Well, I think because like if he had done longer scenes and had moved with one person, like if he had almost split the movie into like thirds, and like only for the last 30 minutes or something, that's then when all the stories converge. Like, you would be bored.
Oh, I think so. I think
because there would have been a lot of points where it's just them driving from one caravan to another caravan or the caravan to the boxing ring or whatever. And like, it would have almost had too much downtime in a way. Whereas by doing the really short scenes, you cut out all of like that travel time almost. So like you just see them actually interact with each other.
Well, and even like the scenes where there's maybe even a bit of action, like I'm thinking about, there's like, I think, what is there? One or two, kind of two boxing matches.
Yeah.
In the movie where it's sort of like, normally you would stay there because now normally you are giving the audience like, here, like, you know, two guys are punching each other. Like,
here's the action that you want. Here's
the action that you wanted. In this movie, he's sort of like, okay, I'm going to give you that, and it's going to slow down the pace a little bit. But, like, at the same time, I'm going to cut to what other characters are doing at the moment that the fight is happening.
I'm also going to have the fights end really quickly.
Yeah, well, that obviously plays into Brad Pitt's character. But, yeah, like, I was just, like, blown away by how quick this movie moves. And then sort of thinking back to being like, did I recognize that as a 13-year-old? Like,
probably not.
Like, again, the movies that I was watching growing up were John Wayne Westerns, like a bit slower. You know, they're not as quick as this movie. And so to go from that to this, I do wonder if maybe that was one of the reasons why I was just like, holy fire, like, what is going on here? Because it was just so intense and so different from what I had been watching.
The other scene that I'm kind of thinking that plays into his editing is the hair chase scene.
Oh, the coursing.
The coursing. Yeah. And that being cut between that and Tyrone.
Yeah.
Being chased.
Yeah.
And the whole like similarness between the two of them. And I was just once again like, that's so clever. Because just watching a hare run away from two dogs could be boring. But having it kind of be like, oh, well, the big guy is also a hare.
doesn't move quite as spryly and elegantly as the hare does. Well, watching the coursing scene the other night, I was like, this is maybe the one scene that as a 34-year-old who, you know, likes animals.
Yeah.
But maybe doesn't sit so well anymore.
Oh, for me, it was the dog fighting. when they end up in the dogfighting ring.
That would be another scene. I think I conveniently overlooked that scene. Yeah, again, like as a 13-year-old, I was sort of like, what is forcing? Who cares? But watching it the other night, I was sort of like, oh, yeah, this scene.
Yeah.
This is tough. This is not fun. Speaking of fun, though, one of the things that Guy Ritchie loves to do is give his gangsters very creative, very alliterative names.
Okay.
Nicknames. And so, you know, out of this movie, the ones that I pulled were like Bullet Tooth Tony.
Yeah.
We got Bricktop. We got Frankie Four Fingers. Turkish, not very alliterative, but definitely different.
Well, the backstory, it was what?
That's how the movie opens.
We find out he's named Turkish because his parents saw a plane crash, or
they were on the plane
crash. They were on the plane crash.
And it was a Turkish airline.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, rough name to grow up with, though.
And then Tommy.
Yeah, he claims it's named after the gun. But looking back at some of his other movies, we've talked about Lock, Stock, and maybe we'll talk about it, you know, in a bit, a little bit more. But out of that movie, I had Soap and Bacon. I had Barry the Baptist, which might be the best name of the bunch because his whole thing was that he drowns people.
Okay.
And you're like, that is actually quite funny. We got Hatchet Harry out of Rock and Rolla, which is kind of like, if you wanted to put this in a trilogy of movies, you probably could do Lock, Stock, Snatch, and then Rock and Rolla. They're all kind of similar in terms of, you know, there's about five or six storylines with about 20 characters, and they all converge onto like one item. Some people say that like he's ripping himself off. I enjoy all three of those movies, so I don't really care.
Okay.
But out of that movie, we got Jared Butler's characters named 1-2, Idris Elba's named Mumbles. We got Handsome Bob is Tom Hardy. Like, just these names are ridiculous. The only one that I don't like that's kind of maybe a little bit similar in terms of this like geezer gangster UK movies is his movie called Revolver, which is the movie that he did before Rock and Roll, I think. And that might be my least favorite movie from Guy Ritchie that I've actually seen.
Okay.
And I think it's, you know, I'm not saying it's because of this reason, but in that movie, the only sort of weird name that I could find was some character named French Paul.
Yeah.
And you're sort of like, what? Like, why did he not?
There's also somebody named Sorter.
Yeah, but I don't know if that's just a name. I honestly can't remember that movie.
Oh, okay. I don't know if it was a name or maybe a job description.
Yeah, I honestly, like, I watched that once when it came out because I was like, oh, it's a new Guy Ritchie movie. And then was like, this is really bad.
Okay.
And never, ever wanted to watch it again. So, yeah, I wonder how much time he spends on the names is really what I'm getting at. Because he obviously loves doing it. And, you know, you can't sort of plagiarize yourself. But, like, how do you come up with names like Soap or Bricktop? Like, where are those coming from?
I wonder if it is just when he's... Because did he write the script as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, like, when he's writing, he maybe just fills in kind of something just to kind of be like, well, that's... I'll come back to this later and I'll give them an actual name. And then by the end, he's just kind of like, no, Bricktop kind of fits. Well, we're just going to keep Bricktop. Like,
they all kind of work. And, like... You know, the thing that, like, Barry the Baptist and Hatchet Harry are kind of the two bad guys from Lock, Stock. Bricktop is the bad guy in this one. Honestly, couldn't tell you who the bad guy is in Revolver. Doesn't really matter. And in Rock and Rolla, the bad guy, he just has, like, a regular name because he's, like, supposed to be a businessman. He's not really a gangster. You're sort of like, those names are all a little scary. Like, if I was being brought in somewhere and they're just like, the person you're about to meet is Hatchet Harry, I'd be like, oh, fuck. Like,
I'm done.
Like,
I'm done
for. I gotta be on my best behavior here. We get that scene pretty early on where they talk you through Bricktop and who he is and, you know, his methods and whatnot. You're just like, this guy fucking is terrifying. Like, I wouldn't want to be on his bad side.
I think Alan Ford does such a good job at playing him too. Because, like, you kind of, the look of him, you're kind of like, well, maybe he's like a sweet guy or whatever. And then like he starts talking and the way he holds his mouth the whole time. And then, yeah, him just sitting there being like, well, I'd love, like, go get me a cup of tea while I scare some shit out of these guys.
Exactly. Like, yeah, he's just sitting casually drinking tea, which, you know, it's a British movie. But yeah, talking about Nemesis and talking, telling these people how to get rid of a body.
Yeah.
And that you feed it to pigs. And you're just like, this guy.
And the two guys then are just kind of like, who are you?
Yeah, exactly. Like... they don't even know who he is. He just walked into their shop. I think the fun thing, too, about sort of this and Lockstock is that Alan Ford is the actor. Alan Ford, who's the bad guy in this movie, is the narrator and, like, one of the good guys in Lockstock.
Oh, really?
And so you're sort of like, oh, like, you know,
this something happened in Alan Ford's life to go from good guy to bad guy.
Who knows? Obviously, Guy Ritchie saw something there. And, like, Bricktop's a great villain. He's a great villain. Because on one hand, he does control sort of the criminal underground with this, like, iron fist. And everyone is afraid of him. And, like, we're primed through Turkish's narration to sort of be like, oh, this guy is somebody that you fear. You know, and he will feed you to pigs. He has no problem with that. But then on the other hand, we see him at the fights talking to, obviously, businessmen or, you know, business tycoons or whoever who are there to gamble on his fights. And he's scared of them. And you do wonder then, like, obviously he is trying to send out this image of himself that, you know, he's struggling to maintain. And you're sort of like, that's a good villain. It's a good villain. Because he's not just evil. He's only evil to people that he can be evil to. But he's just, like, subservient to these other people.
Yeah. And he's scary all the time.
Well, yeah. When you have pigs and dogs, it is scary. I can tell you I've never looked at pigs the same since watching this movie. No. Because when he goes through the whole line about, like, they will chew through bone like butter, you're just like, that is horrifying.
So you're a little nervous then that our uncle has pigs?
Well, I'm never getting close to them, I'll tell you that much. I will stand on the other side of the barrier.
Just kind of looking through Guy Ritchie's films and stuff, we've definitely talked about it with other guys. I think Tarantino, we've talked about it. He likes his people. He always brings them back and stuff. So, like, Jason...
Statham
was in a few. Vinnie Jones is in a few. Mark Strong's in a few. And stuff. So
I think he finds these people that obviously like working with him and he likes working with them. And because of the nature of definitely these types of movies, it's probably not that big of a commitment because you know that, like, yes, your character is going to be in the entire movie, but you don't need to be in every single scene.
That's true.
So he can just have you come in for a bit and out for a bit and in for a bit and out for a bit. And, you know, it probably helps with their other schedules.
I wonder how long they were kind of committed to filming. Like, did they film scene, like, their entire thing in 2 weeks?
And then they're done. I have no idea. The other thing that he obviously then likes doing is he likes bringing in people who were not necessarily actors to begin with.
Okay.
And he likes making them actors.
Oh, like?
Well, Vinnie Jones.
Oh, okay.
So I had this conversation with somebody just quite recently. We were talking about Vinnie Jones. And I said... oh, yeah. Well, like, he had a pretty good soccer career before he started acting. And the person that I was talking to was, like, flabbergasted. Like, what are you talking about? He was a soccer... and I was brought up his whole Wikipedia page. And I was like, he had a career as a soccer player that, like, 95% of professional soccer players would dream of having.
Yes.
And then he became an actor and has had this second career as an actor... where it's sort of like, yeah, he's not making highbrow stuff. But he works every year on, like, multiple projects. And you're like, this guy is, like, he's doing it. He's a working actor.
I forgot about him. Because looking at his photo, I didn't kind of quite recognize him. But I remember the first time I watched She's the Man.
Yeah.
And you came in. And you're like, what's he doing here? I was like, well, he's a part of the movie. And you're like, he's a football player.
Yeah. See, Vinnie Jones... this is a rough estimate, but I think he's played something like 300 games in the English top flight. So in the Premier League or when it used to be the first division, he played 300 games.
Yeah, he played from 1984 to 1999.
Like, that is an unbelievable career. An unbelievable career that so many people would be like, you know, would give their right hand for. He did it. You know, he won the FA Cup. He played for Wales 9 times, I think, or 10 times. Like, that is an unbelievable soccer career. Now, he was a bit of a goon.
Yeah. He seems like a kind of a goon player.
Yeah, like, definitely Guy Ritchie watching Vinnie Jones as a soccer player would be like, yeah, he can definitely play the gangster. I think he still holds the record for quickest red card in a game.
Really?
I think it's like 10 seconds. Like, he immediately, as the game started.
Did he go and, like, punch somebody?
I think yes, more or less. Okay. Yeah, like, he was definitely a bit of a goon. But, like, he played in these games. He played against some of the greatest players of all time. And, like, I'm blown away that, you know, he then parlayed that into this 20-plus year acting career, which, like, he works all the time. So, obviously, he must be good on set. He must be fun to hang around. He must be professional because he keeps getting jobs.
I would say he probably has, like, fun stories.
Oh, I'd like, say he's got great stories.
Because, like, yeah. Going from soccer world to movie world, like, there's probably so many things he could be like, well, I'll tell you about this time or whatever. Like,
oh, I'm sure he's got great stories. I would love to sit down with Vinnie Jones. Because, like, your whole conversation could be, like, soccer one half and then acting the other. And he would, you know,
he would be the perfect person for you to talk to. Oh, my like,
God. I would love to sit down and talk to him. But yeah, like, so, you know, I think his role in Lock, Stock was the first time he'd ever sort of really acted.
Yeah.
And then he obviously has this now a relationship with Vinnie Jones where he shows up every once in a while in these movies. And, you know, he's gone on to a huge, huge career. The other soccer player turned somewhat actor is, I think, David Beckham has a very brief scene in the King Arthur movie.
Oh, yeah, that, I think so,
that,
yeah.
That Guy Ritchie did, where, like, he does have lines. It's not like a cameo where he's just standing in the background. He has lines. He's a character.
Okay.
So, yeah, like, you know, obviously Ritchie likes, I think he just likes having fun.
Yeah.
I think he looks at the whole thing of movie making and sort of like, yes, it's his career. And yes, he, you know, there are things he has to do in these movies. But he's sort of like,
if I'm going to be with these guys for,
let's fuck around a bit.
Yeah. If I'm going to be with these guys for hours on end, for days on end,
I want my friends.
Yeah.
I want to be hanging out with my friend. Like, him and David Beckham, I think, are friends. And sort of like, yeah, just come out, you know, for a few days.
Should we talk about Brad Pitt and his pikey performance?
I love Brad Pitt in this movie.
He's awesome.
I love Brad Pitt. This is definitely one of my favorite Brad Pitt
really?
Movies. Yeah. Well, because it definitely would have been one of the first ones. And he steals the movie.
Yeah.
He's the best character.
We were watching it here, whatever, night last week. And I had the subtitles on. And I was watching with Mom. And she's like, I don't know how I watched this the first time without subtitles. Because so many of his scenes, you have no idea what he's actually said.
No.
Only because of the subtitles. You're like, oh, that's what he actually says this time. Like,
but I think that's kind of the point, too, is that, like, it's not that you're not supposed to know, but it's supposed to be like, who cares?
Yeah.
If you pick up on it, great. If you don't, it doesn't really matter because all of the characters in the movie are also confused.
Yeah.
So, like, just let it go. Just let it, what he says does not matter.
And, like, the whole fact that he's just doing this all to buy his mom a caravan. Yeah. She wants the Periwinkle Blue boys.
Partial to the Periwinkle Blue. But, I just, like, his whole sort of introduction, his whole demeanor, those like first few scenes where you're sort of like, he's a bit of a jokester, he's a bit of a whatever. And, you know, he's obviously playing with the boxer that Tommy brings. And then they get in the ring and the boxer starts beating the shit out of him.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, you'll take one punch. You'll take one punch. And then that one punch fucking nearly kills him. And you're just like, oh, who is this guy? Who is this guy? And yeah, the whole concept of bare knuckle boxing and these traveling families. It's like they've done documentaries on this.
Yeah.
And like this is a whole sub world where these people go out into lanes or into fields or into barns and have these like horrifically brutal bare knuckle boxing matches with like thousands of dollars on the line. And it's a winner take all sort of thing. And like they call each other out. And it's a whole family thing. Like, you know, the whole family gets behind it and whatnot. You're just like, this is wild. This is a wild world. And, you know, Guy Ritchie tapped into that 10, 15 years before really
kind of took off.
It hit mainstream. Like,
yeah.
They've now done documentaries on it. They've done TV shows on it or whatever. But, like, in 2001, 2002, like, I'm not sure if I knew anyone who would have talked about it.
No.
Who would have known what was going on. So, just interesting. The other, like, just to bring it back to Vinnie Jones, though, the other character I do love is Bullet Tooth Tony.
Okay.
Because I, like, again, like, him and Brad Pitt as Mickey are kind of the two characters that they're not there at the very, very beginning. It kind of takes a little while to meet them. But as soon as they show up, you're just like, oh, these are the two best characters.
Really?
Yeah, they're the two best characters, for sure.
The two best characters or the two best performances?
Well, like, I like Brad Pitt's performance as Mickey. I think it's pretty good. I don't necessarily know if, like, we're talking Oscar caliber performance here. I just think the character of Mickey is so interesting. And okay. So, you know, and obviously as the movie goes on, you find out more about what he's actually up to. And you're just like, oh, this guy is, he's on another level. This guy's great. Bullet Tooth Tony showing up in this flashback scored to Madonna's Lucky Star, where we watch him get shot 6 times and then he kills somebody with a sword. You're just like, hold on. Press pause on this movie because I need to rewatch that scene.
I'm trying to remember, though, in this, he does die, right?
Yes.
Bullet Tooth. Yeah. But, like, after a lot of gunshots. Or, no, one gunshot by his own gun.
Yeah.
He shoots somebody else a bunch of times, and they don't die.
That's Boris the Bullet Dog. Yeah. Again, these names. These names. It's actually Boris the Blade or Boris the Bullet Dodger.
Yes.
Can be either one. And why do they call him the Bullet Dodger? Well, because he dodges bullets. But yes, he is the one who, like, he unloads an entire clip into him. Like, I think it's like 8 shots and Boris still won't die. Tony does unfortunately die.
To one shot by his own gun.
By his own gun.
Yes.
Because Abby just starts shooting wildly, trying to shoot the dog. We haven't actually said the words diamond yet.
Oh, yeah.
Which is that's like the whole point of the movie is that they're all chasing this diamond, this 84 carat diamond.
See, for me, like, they all weren't, though.
Well, that's the thing. They don't know that they are.
Yeah.
Like, Turkish and Tommy don't, like, they have nothing to do with the diamond until the very end of the movie.
Yeah.
So that's, yo. It's just fun. Like, who cares?
Because, like, the diamond, yes, is the first scene and everything. And I think, I don't know if I remember it from the first time or not, but it does kind of lead you to think, oh, everybody in this movie is going to be going for this diamond. And about halfway through, you're like, nope, these guys are trying to just get through a boxing match that they've signed up for, but now have lost the fighter for. The other guy is just trying to get his money for the failed boxing match. Mickey just wants the caravan, like, and it is only at the end when other people end up with the diamond, or end up with the dog, I guess, who had the diamond.
Well, it is, like, we've obviously talked about it. It's not necessarily a MacGuffin, because the diamond does matter.
Yeah.
But it is just this thing to, like, kick the story off. It is just a way of being, like, once the diamond is introduced into one story, other dominoes start falling. And, you know, so, like, Frankie with the diamond goes to the bookies. Because he's going to the bookies, the other character has somebody try to go rob the bookies, but he doesn't get there. So they rob the bookies, which then brings Bricktop in to the conversation. You know what I mean? And it does, you know, one event does lead to the other. But, like, yes, like you're saying, they don't necessarily know that there is an 84 carat diamond at the center of this story that they all should be chasing after. And I do like the fact that Turkish and Tommy get the diamond at the end, because he does have that line just a few minutes earlier where he's sort of like, they had done all this stuff over the course of the movie and they're actually worse off financially than they were at the beginning. And, like, what they were trying to do was level up a little bit. And of course they just come across the diamond in this dog and it's sort of like, yeah, you guys are going to be fine. You're going to be fine.
Thinking about another scene where, like, one event caused something else to cause something else is the one where they're all in the cars driving to wherever they all were going. I don't think they were going to the same spot, but well, I can't quite remember where they all.
Yes. Yeah, so Tony, Avi, and Rosebud.
Yes.
With Boris in their trunk are going to Boris's house to get the diamond.
Yes.
Tommy and Turkish are going to Boris's house to get a new gun for Tommy. Because Boris had sold him a gun that didn't work.
Yes.
And then Saul and Vincent are just following Tony because they know that he has the diamond at that moment.
So that whole scene, though, where it starts with Boris being hit by a car.
Yes.
And then we get into another story, and it's actually...
like a couple minutes earlier.
A couple minutes earlier. Yeah. So, like, the whole thing starts with Tommy and Turkish throwing out a thing of chocolate milk, I think.
Yeah.
It hits a car, bullet-tooth Tony's car.
Yeah.
Which then forces him to crash. Boris then hops out of the trunk, and then Boris gets hit.
Yeah.
And I was just like...
And Boris survives.
And then Boris survives and goes home, gets a gun, and comes back again.
Yeah.
I just... that scene, when it starts off and starts with Boris being hit, you do have a second of, wait, how did we get here?
Yeah.
Like, what? Like, did I miss something? Did I close my eyes? What happened? And then when they work kind of back from that point and to that point again, it is just like, that's so clever.
Yeah. It's just like, again, like, I think it's maybe not the best example of good editing or whatever, but it is just fun. Like, I think that's Guy Ritchie, at least at this time, that was like his MO, where it's just like, let's just fuck around. Let's just have a good time. This is a movie about gangsters chasing a diamond. Like, let's have a good time with this. Let's, you know what I mean? It doesn't have to be that serious.
So you've kind of talked about how you love Guy Ritchie at this time.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about recent Guy Ritchie?
Well, so like, the thing about it is, it's not even that I've disliked the movies that he's made. It's just that I flat out haven't watched them.
Oh, okay.
So, like, So, like, obviously, he starts with Lock, Stock, love it. He goes to Snatch, love it. He then does the Swept Away movie with Madonna. Never saw it because...
Madonna?
It's Madonna. I don't really care. He then, I think, the next move then is the Sherlock movies, which we both love.
Yeah.
You know, even the sequel. I think the sequel people don't necessarily like. I like both. I think they're both really fun. It's probably my favorite thing Robert Downey Jr. has ever done.
Really?
Because I'm not really an Iron Man fan.
That's true.
And so he's kind of doing Iron Man, but as Sherlock Holmes, and sort of like, okay, I can handle that. Does those. He then does this other movie called The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which is like a movie version of like, I think, a 60s TV show. And I fucking love The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Okay.
It's like a real hidden gem, underseen movie where it has all of the sort of Guy Ritchie style, but because it's like spies and espionage, it's not gangsters. You're sort of like, oh, this is a bit more interesting. Like, this is a bit more sort of elevated or whatever you want to say. But yeah, like it's just like dripping in style. And at this stage, like, you know, he'd done these gangster movies, the Sherlock movies, we should say, also have a ton of style. So like, I think at this point in his career, like, he knew what he was doing. And then he gets into Disney. And he makes Aladdin. And I just remember being like, why the fuck is Guy Ritchie making an Aladdin movie?
I don't think I knew that he did Aladdin. I've seen it, but I don't think I realized that it was him until I was looking at this.
Well, so that kind of goes to my point in terms of like, I think that was definitely a paycheck job. And like,
yeah, fair enough.
Fair enough. Good on you. Like, get Disney's money. I don't care about that. But it is sort of like, why Aladdin? What about Aladdin spoke to Guy Ritchie?
Yeah.
You know, I'm confused. I don't really know. And so he did kind of lose me there. And then he makes this other movie called Wrath of Man, which is him teaming up with Jason Statham again. And I remember that coming out. And I remember people sort of being like, this is really good. And just watching the trailer and sort of being like, no. Like, nothing about this screams, I need to watch this. And then he did two movies last year. He had two movies come out in 2022. One called Operation Fortune, Ruse de Guerre or whatever.
Came out 2023.
Sorry, 2023. I meant 2020. Yeah, I forgot we're in 2024 now. Operation Fortune, Ruse de Guerre, which is, I think, another Jason Statham movie. And I think, I don't know who else is in it. Hugh Grant, I think, people are in it. And then this movie called The Covenant, which is him and Jake Gyllenhaal. And I was just like, pass on both. Like,
really?
I was just like, there was nothing about it screamed, I need to watch these movies.
Okay.
And
so I've kind of fallen out of love with Guy Ritchie
a little bit. I think the movie, it's not necessarily even a bad movie, but I think the movie that kind of did it was The Gentleman, the movie that he did with Matthew McConaughey, where, you know, I've already said that, like, I don't necessarily mind that Lockstock, Snatch, and Rock'n'Rolla are essentially the same movie. But then when I watched The Gentlemen, I was like, oh, this is the same thing. Like, you know,
oh, okay.
It's kind of the same thing again. And I was just sort of like, it's not even that bad, but it's definitely not good. And I was like, just kind of, I was like, I think I've just moved on. I think I've just moved on from Guy Ritchie.
You kind of aged out of him.
I think I've aged out a little bit. I can go back and watch the early stuff and enjoy the early stuff. But I think I've just aged out of his, like, sense of humor, of his shtick. Again, to bring this back to Tarantino, he had an interview, I think, when he was sort of first coming up and whatnot. And he was talking about Godard, the French director. And obviously, like, you know, there is definitely influence on Tarantino's movies from Jean-Luc Godard. But he spoke about the fact that he had, like, aged out of Godard. Like, at one point, Godard was his guy, was the most important influence, the most important filmmaker on his style, on his career. But that over the years, he had just grown out of it. And he's sort of like, that's going to happen to him. I think it was like the point that he was making is like, there are people that love my movies now. They will grow out of them as they watch more movies or as they, you know, see more people or whatever it is. You know what I mean? And I think that that's what's happened with Guy Ritchie, with me, where it's sort of like, 13, 14, 15 years old, he was my number one guy.
Yeah.
He was my favorite filmmaker. He made my favorite movies. You know, I can remember when Rock'n'Rolla came out, I think it was like 18 or 19. And I was supposed to go to like a house party, but I had started Rock'n'Rolla. And I was like, I'm not leaving until I finish the movie. Like, I could have just paused the movie and come back the next day. But I was like, no.
I feel like that describes you and your friends and your view on social,
I was like,
social situations.
It's a new Guy Ritchie movie. I'm not going to sit down and watch it at the first possible opportunity. And I think at this point, now that I'm an old man, I just have aged out. I don't care about his version of King Arthur. I don't care about, you know, his movie, I think, about the Iraq War, which I think is what The Covenant is about. You know, he's making another Aladdin movie.
Yeah, Aladdin 2 and Hercules.
And Hercules, which are like, both of those, like, I absolutely do not care about. But the one that he's making, which I think is maybe going to come out this year or maybe next year, is The Ministry for Ungentlemanly Warfare.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of just like, no. No, like, I nothing about the title. You know, I'm sure the cast is great because he gets great actors, but it's sort of just like, this could be fantastic, but it's going to have to be really fucking great for me to care about watching it.
So that one is a spy film based on the 2014 book Churchill's Secret Warriors.
I just don't know. Like, I'm certainly not rushing out to see it in movie theaters. I'll say that much for you.
Me and Chris might check it out. Chris is a big Churchill fan, so I'll tell you if it's any good.
I don't think this is going to be historically accurate.
No.
I'll say that right now, having no information about the movie. The one that I am curious about, which I saw the trailer for the other day, which I won't watch because I don't have Netflix anymore, but, you know, I'll be curious to see what other people say about it, is he is making a Gentleman Netflix show.
Oh, okay.
And so I think it's going to be... Based off the movie.
Okay.
But I think it's going to be a bit of an extension on the movie. Like, I don't necessarily know if any of the characters are going to be the same. I think it's going to be a new cast of characters. But it's going to be set in the world of The Gentleman. And I watched the trailer. And again, I sort of was like, okay, cool trailer. I don't own Netflix and I don't really watch TV. So, like, I'm probably not going to race out to go watch this TV show on Netflix.
Well, you're also not a big TV guy, so.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
And so, but I was sort of like, okay, that is definitely interesting. And I wonder if having more time is actually going to be a good thing or a bad thing on his style. Like we've said about Snatch, do we bring it back to Snatch? Snatch kind of works because it never slows down.
Yeah.
It never, ever lets you have a moment of like, this is getting a little boring. Because it flat out just refuses to let you do that.
It just kind of runs the entire time.
It's sprinting. And so I wonder if, I don't know what the show is going to be, but like I imagine it's going to be 6 hours, 8 hours, whatever, you know, seems to be a pretty standard length. If A, he'll be able to sustain that pace, because I don't think he'll be able to for that long.
No, there will definitely be kind of down.
There has to be down moments. There has to be slower moments. And so then I wonder if the slower moments will actually improve the overall feeling, because then you can sort of be like, okay, I can breathe now. Got a couple minutes to relax before we ramp up again. Or if you'll be sitting there being like, oh, this should have been a 2-hour movie.
Yeah.
That's what I'm curious about with this show.
Is there any kind of release date for it? Must be soon if there's a trailer.
I think it's soon. Like, I think it's March.
Oh, okay.
So I think it's definitely soonish. Like, it is finished. I'm pretty sure that he directed at least some of the episodes, and then like definitely produced the series. I don't know sort of how much involvement he actually did have, but yeah, I'll just be curious once that comes out to sort of be like, what's the conversation around the Gentleman TV show?
Hmm.
Any last thoughts or moments that you want to talk about for Snatch?
No, so far 2 for 2 for the podcast though. So we're doing pretty good this year, I think.
I did enjoy going back. Like,
yeah,
I haven't watched Snatch in over a decade. So it was fun to go back and watch it again. Sort of like, this is nuts.
This was great.
And like, I probably should have found a way to watch Lockstock in there as well, because Lockstock is, it's one of those sort of, Rock and Roll is definitely third. I love Rock and Roll. It's definitely third.
Okay.
Lockstock and Snatch were always kind of like, which did I watch more recently?
Like kind of the 1-2 yeah, kind of swap.
They're kind of tied in my mind and estimation. Lockstock is definitely like smaller and grittier. And like, there's no movie stars in that movie whatsoever. Like, it's Jason Statham, but he's not Jason Statham at that yeah, point. Whereas he's able to get way more money and way more movie stars for Snatch because people liked Lockstock. But yeah, I should have watched it. I ran out of time. What are you going to do?
So next week?
Next week, should we tease? Do you want to tease next week? You know what it is this time.
I do know what it is this time because we've actually decided. Another favorite of ours.
Yeah.
I think my personal, out of the trilogy, I think it was my favorite.
Yes. Yeah, so we're going back to do another sequel.
Yeah.
From a movie that we did last year. And this is your favorite.
I think this one was my favorite.
Okay. You yeah, have a lot to answer for. Because people do not like this movie. We love this movie, which is why we're doing
yes,
it.
Yes.
But people do not like this movie so much. So yeah, we'll have to comb through some of the comment sections, I think.
And see what people are saying about it.
See what people are saying and see if we can maybe mount a defense.
Okay.
For this movie. But yeah, that'll be next week. So we'll see everybody then.
See you then.